this is Baby Jane Dexter, blues and cabaret singer based out of New York City, and you're here with me on Days Gone By on UNC Radio. Is this Rabbi Saul?
Shalom, shalom, hello, is this Baby Jane Dexter?
Yes, it is.
Oh, shalom, welcome, welcome to the neighborhood, as we call it. Ms. Dexter, a pleasure to talk to you and to welcome you to this radio program of the air. Let me tell the people a little bit about you before we get into our conversation. Baby Jane Dexter is a singer, a chanteuse, if you will, and I hope you will, because she has won 6 MAC Awards, which are the Manhattan Nightlife Cabaret Awards there. You've got two Nightlife Awards and 2 Bistro Award wins as well. I know Sherry Eaker has been a guest on this radio program as well. Baby Jane Dexter is the premier singer, if anybody remembers Ringo Sweeney's when that opened. She also has sung at 88 and the Blue Note and the Russian Tea Room and maybe the Polish Tea Room too, which they're closing. Have you heard about this?
Polish Tea Room, I didn't know there was one.
Well, the Edison Hotel.
They would have pierogies and not a...
That's true, not blinis. No, but the Polish Tea Room was always the jokey name of the Edison Hotel.
Really, on 47th Street?
Yeah, the one that's 45 seconds from Broadway. What do they call it? It's the...
They call it closed.
That's right, there you go, exactly.
But ended or it's ending, recently.
It has closed already?
As I just said, it's either closed already or is closing...
Imminently, yeah, yeah. Another piece of New York is going by the wayside. But we still have with us, thank God, Baby Jane Dexter. Let me tell you what Chip DeFa of the New York Post wrote about her. And Chip is a friend of Dave and has known him for...
Really?
Yes, Dave has known him for before he became a review putter together, when he was actually reviewing cabaret for the New York Post, and now he's making his own musicals and stuff. But,
absolutely, and he also has a number of books on jazz singers and blues singers.
Oh, very good. He's a very talented man, as you're not a talented man, you're a talented woman. Quote.
I could be in transition.
Well, we can talk about that operation in a little bit. If you want to hear songs that haven't been done to death by everyone else, sung by a powerhouse whose belief in her material feels unshakable, savor Baby Jane Dexter, and no less a personage than Stephen Holden of the New York Times said, a performance...
Very important guy.
I mean, yeah, he is. He's one of the, Bob Hoagland. Who else?
John Hoagland.
John Hoagland, right?
Or Bob Harrington, who's been dead since 1992.
Well, that's a problem
world.
For him. But all these people, you knew these people, you sang for these people.
Yes.
And Stephen Holden of the New York Times said, and this is a quote, a performance by the cabaret singer Baby Jane Dexter is like a revival meeting without Jesus. Which is my kind of revival meeting, honestly, yes?
That's very, very complimentary.
You can hear her music by going to her website, babyjanedexter.com, and most importantly, she is in the midst of a gig at the Metropolitan Room between November 21st and the end of this year, December 27th. Do you want to tell us the exact days and times when people can see you?
Yes, let's see. We've just done 2, I don't know who we is.
Several U's, yes.
Yeah, several U's. The next shows are Friday and Saturday at 7, the day after Thanksgiving and the day after that. And then in December, there are 3 shows. I know that you people, if you're listening, you need to get your pens and your pencils.
That's right. And please don't call us you people. We're Jews. But no, I'm kidding. Keep going. Wait a minute, how do you know this?
Because I went to someone's Seder and I learned this. And I wanted to be the youngest, so I wanted to be the one that gets the matzah.
Oh, very good. Well, but can you do the ch sound?
Oh. You're very cute, Saul, Rabbi Saul.
Well, you're not so bad yourself. Thank you.
Wait, we got to go back to December 2014. believe it's the 20th, and then the 26th and 27th.
So for Goyim, after Christmas, you know, you've gotten through the horrible holidays with your families, you can celebrate and do something actually good by going to the Metropolitan Room and seeing Baby Jane Dexter in her new cabaret show called Rules of the Road, Part 3. I assume there were two other parts?
Yes, sir.
So tell us about this new part.
Well, it's just that I think that about 2 years ago I came up with Part 1. The rules of the road is just, you know, the rules of the world. The world, by how I see.
Okay.
The rules of the world. So it's.
But how do the songs you choose relate to your view of the world?
Anything that I sing relates to my view of the world. That's what it is.
Okay.
I do. I mean, it's not just hear some songs or that I think I sound good singing. I never choose a song to show off or to be, you know, make it like I'm the terrific singer. I choose the song that has the thing that I'm talking about, that I want to say. And how the show, be it any show that I do, particularly the Rules of the Road, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, I guess we could just keep having parts, you know, Part 4 or 5, 6. Sure. Anyway, the thing is that sequencing or how the show unfolds is what defines the show. I don't ever describe a song before I sing it because if it's known, why bother singing it? If I do a masterclass, I tell people don't announce your song you're going to sing if it's a known song, because whoever made that song famous is what's going to go through the audience's head. So I do a lot of songs that oftentimes people don't realize they are the song that they are until they recognize it. I don't, like, go, I'm going to make a secret out of this. It's just the way I hear it and the way I sing it.
Before you frighten people off, I do want to say that you do several songs that people will know quite well. The songs by people like Rodgers and Hammerstein and Randy Newman and Cy Coleman and Peter Allen and Lieber and Stoller. So it's not, you know, like you're doing incredible obscurities, but at the same time...
No, what I'm saying is that you might hear a song that you know, but you might take you a little while before you realize that that is a song you know, because you're hearing my interpretation of it.
It's kind of like Bob Dylan in concert for the past 30 years. You know, he gets three quarters of the way through a song before you realize, oh my God, that's Blowing in the Wind. Well, maybe not quite the same thing. How long does it take you to put a new cabaret evening together?
Okay, it can take a very long time, like at least 6 months. I mean, or a year, because it's something that I think about, and if something comes to me, I want to sing this, and then I build a show around whatever that thought is. Like, since I'm well known as a cabaret singer, but, you know, a lot of people just think the word cabaret is the name of a movie, and it's a venue, you know, a place where people go. It's usually intimate, meaning, like, you know...
Sexual.
100
no,
or... What?
No, I said sexual, but I was joking. That intimate, get it?
Hope so, you poor thing. But the thing is, well, however I sing any songs in particular, if it's in a boite, B-O-I-T-E, or it's in a concert hall, or it's by a swamp in Okeechobee, Florida, under a tent.
Hey, if it's in Florida, Jews will come, even if it's in a tent. But it has to be early. You have to be home for dinner by 4:30. But still, even in that tent, you could do it.
I don't get the 4:30.
Oh, but 4:30 is dinner time.
Okay, I didn't know.
It's a joke.
Particularly Jewish, but I could be. Like, I'm not a lesbian, but I could be an honorary lesbian. I could be an honorary Jew. I could be anything.
If you can do the Ch and the Magish Tana, you're basically in. You know, maybe go to Africa and get a circumcision, I don't want to know. But that would be the final, perhaps, thing that you would need.
No, you wouldn't want to go to Africa, because they don't do circumcision, they do something worse.
Well, for a woman, that was kind of the joke. Yeah, that was...
Oh, that's really funny. When I said I was in Okeechobee, I also do what I do. I do a workshop with kids, teens, and... An Alternative to Prison, Vision Quest. What I'm bringing to them is another form of expression, an alternative to a knife or a gun. So it's pretty intense. Most of the kids are black or Hispanic, or they are white kids that talk like they're black and Hispanic. It's a very intense thing, and it's very powerful. But it's not different than what I do in a cabaret. You know, it's very... I think I should tell you what I feel like when I'm standing, when the show starts.
Sure.
This could be something referring to something you might have already asked me or would ask me. What I do, I go and wherever it is that I'm going to sing, the people come. When I look out at the people that are in my audience, I see above their heads, each head has a cartoon bubble above it.
Yeah.
And in each bubble is a different thing from all these people. Could be something about trying to get a parking space. It could be an argument that they had with their boss before they went out for dinner and the show. Could be something that happened with their husband or wife or their partner or whoever. Just all kinds of different things. So everybody is coming to this show of mine, and I think they would go to anyone's show this way, although I don't know that everybody realizes or thinks about this, but this is what I see. Each person has this cartoon bubble above their head that has something about their day, and you know, whatever it puts them in the mood that they're in when they come. As I start the show, I see all these cartoon bubbles. As the show progresses, I see these bubbles start to pop, so that by the time the show is over, there are no bubbles anymore. Near the end, there are no bubbles. Everybody is together in what the show is bringing to them. So they've left their thoughts about whatever happened in their day somewhere else, and they're there with me hearing what it is I'm saying in the song. The lyrics are very important.
But that is the purpose of every movie, every theatrical performance, is to pop the bubbles that people come in with. They're thinking about this, they're thinking about that. Within, hopefully not by the end of the show, but hopefully within a third of the way, you've got them hooked enough, whatever the thing that they're watching is, that the bubbles popped and they're with whatever's happening in front of them instead.
Right.
But you talked about Cabaret before. Cabaret, the actual show or the movie.
No. I was just made a reference to that people don't know what a cabaret is.
No, I know, but I am saying that at the very end of the movie and of the musical, the Joel Grey character, the MC, says, "Where are your troubles now? On the outside, they're inside." It's again, I mean, it's ironically used in the film, but it's the same idea. It's like when you came in here, oh, you were worried about the economy in Weimar Germany and the filthy Jews, but now we're all in this cabaret having fun. He's popped the bubble in a manner of speaking.
Right. I'm the only one that I believe refers to this way in terms of performance by a singer and what they have to bring to this audience that happens to come to the show. Well, I just know that what I do is very powerful, and that has been revealed to me. Like, who I am and what I do are the same thing, but what I do has been, and the importance of it and the responsibility of it has been revealed to me over the years. I mean, it's like even when I was like 14 and was in my religious fellowship, because I was brought up Unitarian, we had a very interesting minister who had guest speakers like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X.
Now, wait. You went to see these people? You were young enough?
Came to speak as guests.
And you were there? You saw them speak?
Yes.
Well, what was it? Put us there. What was it like seeing Martin Luther King? Do you remember anything he said at that particular speech, or Malcolm X?
It was important.
Okay.
I'm friends with his oldest daughter.
Whoa.
With Malcolm X's oldest daughter.
Malcolm X. Oh, okay, yeah.
But anyway, I wasn't then. I was just a kid. But all these incredible people, we were exposed in our Unitarian Fellowship to very interesting people, including my own minister, who was I'm blanking right now because I have aphasia from a stroke. But
I did not know that you had. I'm sorry about that. But
Well, but anyway, when I just did a concert in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico, Alfari Wheelwright was the name of my minister, like who walked with Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama. Walk.
Yeah.
And that's how we knew him. Anyway, when I did this year a concert in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico, which is sort of a place where expatriates go and artist colony and stuff, he's down there. He lives there. And I did my concert in the opera house there. It's the same type of thing that I would do in a cabaret. He finally got up at the end of my concert, and I introduced him because he's famous in the city, and he said that he was 96, and...
Gewalt.
I said, you're lying. You're 97. Oh, no, he said he was 99. I said, you're lying. You're 97. And, but he told about something that happened when I was a kid in his church or fellowship. Okay, now, the worst thing is to get me off track. What was I talking about before?
We kind of morphed it from the bubbles over people's heads into Martin Luther King and Malcolm X somehow.
Okay, what I was starting to say was that in this Unitarian Fellowship, I sang sometimes. I was like 14. I was talking about when things revealed themselves as to who I was or am. And as I look back in hindsight, I recognize things that I didn't know then, like when I was 14 and sang a folk song with a friend playing a guitar. And I remember this woman coming up to me at the Unitarian Fellowship saying that what I did meant so much to her that made her feel a certain way. And now, I didn't know what she was talking about. Now, I'm telling you that now.
Okay.
Old, because of 14, I'm not thinking about this. I mean, I'm a kid. I want to be a singer. I want to be this. I want to be. Somewhere along the line, after I started singing professionally, it has revealed itself that people keep, after every show I ever do, there are always at least somebody or there are people who come up to me and telling me how they were affected. It lets me know that I'm doing the right thing. If all I want is that people come to the show and that they leave with something more than they came in with. Not a headache, but something...
A wallet, perhaps. No, I'm kidding. Yes.
I know. You're constantly kidding, but you're off track.
I'm off track. We're talking about thought bubbles, and then suddenly we're in Selma, Alabama, and marshy swamps in Florida. But anywho... We're talking with Baby Jane Dexter, who is at the Metropolitan Room in Manhattan. Do go see her. She has this marvelous career, this longevity career. And by the way, people might be a little bit surprised here that this whole Baby Jane name that you have has nothing to do with the Betty Davis, whatever happened to Baby Jane, any of that.
No. In fact, when I went to L.A. years ago, like in 75, and I went to work at this big fancy nightclub, that in the dressing room was a gigantic picture of Betty Davis with the black stuff coming down her face, like as Baby Jane.
Right.
Like they were bringing this to me. No, how that happened was I was born, I came out of my mother, and she went, oh, look, a baby, Jane.
It was the female equivalent of Junior, in a way, wasn't it?
Yes. You're absolutely correct. In fact, I went to do a television show when I was a teenager. I believe it was on NBC. And the thing is, I went to sign the contract for the AFTRA, which is a union for TV.
Or it was. They merged. They're part of some other union now, I think. But yeah.
Yeah, SAG. Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, everything sags on me at my age. But yes, continue.
Oh, God. You got to do handstands. That's your assignment for Baby Jane.
Okay.
Go everywhere on your hands. That way, every sagging thing will go in the right direction.
Interesting.
Now, what was I saying that you...
Your name. The Baby Jane.
Okay.
Yeah.
What it was, so I went to do the television show. I tried Jane Dexter Jr. So it was interesting that you either assumed that or knew it. I was impressed. I was a fan of Sammy Davis Jr. as a kid.
Jewish, by the way, yes.
Yes. And
and your mom name was Jane? Who was the Jane in your family?
Okay, they said you can't be Jane Dexter because there is already one in the union. And I said, that's my mother. She'll share. And they said, you can't legally do that. So I tried my legal name, Jane N. Dexter. And people thought a duo was coming out.
And also, it's tough for broadcasters to say. You got to stop on one end and start on the other. Like, you're going to give that to Tom Brokaw. I'm not joking. It's like Jane N. Dexter. It would be. So, yeah, you couldn't do that.
I don't get the...
Well, in other words, when you have newscasters, what they read has to be sometimes specifically tailored for them to be most easily able to read it. And you have
one
N followed by another N that becomes very difficult to parse for them verbally and vocally.
Yes. Okay, so this was a joke. Jane N. Dexter, if you say it fast.
It sounds like Anne.
Dexter. Jane Dexter, that sounds like two people.
Right.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Anyway, somewhere along the line, when I was first starting, going to have my first job as a professional singer, this person suggested I do Baby Jane Dexter. And that I said, first of all, I've outgrown smocking. I'm not going to be wearing a little baby dress and a bow in my hair. But I did do the Baby Jane thing, and people remembered it. And actually, my very first job, Danny Aiello was the maitre d' at the Improv, which, is, if you remember the Improv in New York City, it was on 44th and 9th. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. I mean, I didn't realize it was gone. How long has it been gone?
A few years.
Yeah.
I mean, there's improvs all over the...
Well, not that many in Manhattan anymore, but there's a couple.
Well, there's one on Melrose in L.A.
Right.
Where Bud Friedman, who started the Improv, lives and still goes. Bud got a divorce, and his wife had that the Improv in New York.
Was that Mitzi, what's her name? And the Shore people, or is that somebody else?
No, that's Sandy Shore you're talking about, which is in the Comedy Store in L.A.
Ah, my fault. All right. Anyway, back on track. So, yes. Improv and Danny Aiello.
Oh, he got me a job at a bungalow colony, Jewish.
Yay!
Bungalow colony in New Jersey somewhere where I got $50. But when I was at the Improv, singers were they in between the comics. Like, you know, the comics would do a whole set and then the singer would sing one or two songs. I guess that's when the waiters went out and asked them what they wanted. But anyway, when I was at the Improv, somebody said there's a club in the village that's hiring singers. You should go down. And that was Reno Sweeney, which was a club in the 70s that began the resurgence of New York nightlife after rock and roll everywhere. A lot of loud whatever. So this was the first time since like Basin Street East and all those places that the New York nightlife scene came alive with these clubs. It was a guy named Louis Friedman who started that club, and he, when he was in college at Columbia, he used to go to a place on 8th Street and that had Barbara Streisand, had a woman named Felicia Saunders, had a lot of people that were starting out. He was a big fan of Felicia Saunders, and I was the last person Felicia Saunders, this is not a joke, saw before she died. She was a wonderful singer, and I was the last person she had come to see. Not that that means anything about... I don't want to scare the people away that they're going to die if they come to see me. No, they're going to live. That's the whole thing. People, you know, the way everything is with like you said, internet, and the world on social media, and with hip-hop and rap and a lot of things, and there was a long period that people didn't hear actual emotional stuff that they were touched by. And it's like, so when people come to see a cabaret singer, they should feel something in a way that they either used to or that they never have because they're too young.
Right. The used to part is no problem. You still get 50, 60, 70, 80-year-olds going to the theater. It's important to get people who are in their 20s and 30s.
Absolutely. I have many people who bring their kids or bring their a nephew or whatever. But the thing that's interesting is that these people, these kids, the older ones and the younger ones, all feel something. It's like if you are singing and it's from the real place, from the truth that's in your gut, and that could be just the simplest song. Like there's an old song called One Meatball, I don't know if you've heard of that, written in 1929. I forget who was the guy who introduced it, but then a decade or two later, the Andrews Sisters had sung it. The thing is that it's so interesting. Like, each song is like a story. And I'll get back to One Meatball if you remind me. Each song is a story. And I sing the story the way I feel it inside of me. The people listening might hear it just like I do, but they might hear something else depending in the context of what their life is. Like, I went and sang to, like, a bunch of little kids. I brought them up in the Unitarian Fellowship to sit on the, where the podium is.
Uh-huh.
And these little kids, they're 5 years old, and I'm explaining in front of the, well, I don't know what you call the audience. What,
congregation? Or the what?
What are they called? The people sitting there in church?
Congregants, perhaps.
Yeah, the what?
Congregants.
Yes. So I tell the story. Like, you hear something. It might be just the words that you hear. And it might be funny, or it might be this, or you might hear something else. Because we ended up talking about One Meatball. Look, here, I'll do a little.
Please.
What?
I said, please.
A little man walked up and down to find an eating place in town. He read the menu through and through to see what 15 cents could do. One meatball, he could afford but one meatball. Now, there's a small song with a bunch of cute choruses. Like, some people hear it as fun and funny, and they sing along with the one meatball. But some people also hear about humiliation and poverty, like, because in the song, the waiter says, you get no bread with one meatball. And this guy was hungry that was looking at the menu. He goes in and he eats, and the waiter screams out, you get no bread, and the guy is humiliated. So there's something big and powerful about the song, even though it's a cute song and there's a lot of fun in it. So, I mean, you could hear anything in a song. Everybody can hear something else. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can interpret things in a dozen ways, and you hear a song a certain way when you're 15 and you don't hear it, or you hear it in another way when you're 30 or something like
that. Yes, yes. And you also might hear it in a way that you didn't know you could hear it.
Well, there's a story that Amy Mann tells. Have you ever heard of Amy Mann from Till Tuesday, the singer-songwriter? And she says that when she was a kid, she would play records with her friend, and they would listen. And there was a song called Alone Again Naturally by Gilbert O'Sullivan. And so that's a pretty little... And her friend says, you know, if you listen to the lyrics, it's this guy who's depressed and suicidal, right? And she had no idea. It didn't occur to her. And then she listened to the song again, and she was like, a window opened, or maybe she jumped through it, but suddenly she realized, oh my God, there's so much more going on than I was getting.
Well, look, the person that brought that to notice the way that you're describing was, she's dead now, and she's a great, she was black, and she usually sang at the Carlisle.
Was she like 90-something years old, she was still singing? Or am I thinking of the woman at the cookery? No, that's the wrong...
No, but I love the cookery. Because the one there was 95, and I loved her.
You know who I'm talking about, but I can't...
Yeah. And I'm like you right now. But there were a lot of people that sang at the cookery from very Nellie Lutcher, Helen Humes, but the one you're talking about was the greatest. And she was 95. five or six when she died.
But you're talking about somebody else who was at a different venue. And and Dead, which doesn't really narrow it down that much.
Wait a minute. She was so famous and she purred like a cat. That was she was famous for.
Oh, Eartha Kitt.
Yes.
Eartha Kitt the cat, yes.
Okay. Now, I believe it was Eartha Kitt who insulted the wife of one of the presidents to do with her garden and stuff.
Would have been Johnson then, probably.
Yes. So there was a little interview or something with the two of them, and she, Eartha Kitt, insulted, or she said something, it was about racism. She was then banned. What happened was she wasn't put on TV, she wasn't anywhere. She went to London and lived there for a certain period of time. When she came back, she sang Alone Again Naturally.
Oh.
In a way that was so powerful. You know, because it didn't have that, you know, bumpy up in it. It was like, not in a little while, then. It was a ballad, and it was deep, and you heard it the way you described Amy Mann talking about it.
Right.
And I remember seeing it, and it was shocking. It was so powerful. So, yeah, you can hear all that stuff. Look, when I do a master class, I tell the students, people do not want to leave their homes to listen to you, listen to yourself sing. That is not what people want to do. As a singer, and this is what I tell myself, or have told myself and recognize, you have a responsibility to give these people something that they feel, something that they get to take with them, that so many people haven't heard in years because the music has been different. A lot of people, like I remember singing at a club called 88 in New York about 20 years ago, and some people brought people to see me, and somebody brought a person who was a conductor from classical music,
okay.
Who didn't like singers particularly and didn't care, but he went with his friend just and happened to be brought to see me. Afterwards, he told me that he had never paid attention before to the lyric because he was always in the music, but that was what he got from his experience with me. Hearing things like that from various people lets me know what my job is. Lets me know it's not about me being a singer and having people be excited about me. Like, I remember getting this big bunch of reviews and having a big thing on channel ABC News about me performing and everything like that. And I was at a place called Tramps, and it was a place where you worked four nights a week. I went in for 2 weeks and stayed for 12. Now, the thing is, I remember, because of the TV, the place was packed, and they're all waiting for me. I was standing at the back of the room, and waiting to go on. I'm sure you've heard this from actors and a lot of people that you have interviewed and things that you recognize and know yourself. I was totally afraid. I was sitting there, how am I ever going to live up to what people have said about me? And I think that's a common thing that happens to performers or singers, that they, if people write good things about them, it's like they get the compliments, they get the this and that, and then they have to be that for the people.
Right.
And I have been a singer and stopped for 10 years, got married, had depression, had lost my hair from a disease, all the stuff. When I came back to singing, it was through my friend who I helped take care of named Vito Russo, a film authority and an AIDS activist, and Common Thread, Stories of the Quilt, that won an Academy Award for Best Documentary. He was one of the subjects. Anyway.
But he was not your husband. He was just a gay friend, right?
He was a fan. I met him. He did my first interview.
Oh, my goodness.
In 1973.
Wow.
I mean, he became, I mean, I became one of his care people when he,
right, when he
died. And he was a very famous in a certain way, and the mayor came to see him. He was a big deal, and he was a big Baby Jane fan, and I mean huge. And we used to, when he would be in L.A. or some part of the country doing a panel on film, I would arrange to have a gig in that same city, and that way we could be, you know, I could go hear him talk on his panel, and he could come see me sing, and it was, or hear me sing. And I remember, I had not been singing for 10 years during the 80s, and I remember Vito was dying, and he said, I went to his apartment to help him with his pentamidine drip and, you know, all the stuff, medicine and stuff.
Sure.
And I brought a cassette player with me and with an accompaniment on it. And I told him that I was going to sing for him there that way, because he kept saying, when am I ever going to hear you sing again? Because I had stopped doing the thing that I was supposed to do. And I arranged to have do a afternoon show for a few weeks at like a Sunday brunch thing at 88th in New York City, so that he would be able to come and see me sing. Because when I was going to sing to him at his house, his apartment, he said, I don't know, that's not what I want. I want to hear you, I want to see you sing to people.
Mm.
And he said, what you do is affect people through your singing. That's what you do. And if you're not doing it, and you're not doing who you are. That was the thing that was the revelation. You know what I mean? And
Well, let me ask you,
sure.
Jane Dexter, is has singing also been cathartic and healing for you? Because you're very open here and also on your website of all the rather terrible things have happened to you over your life.
Well, you're talking about rape, right?
Well, you also, I know you lost your hair from another disease and you had a stroke, you just said.
But I think it was depression from not singing. I was lost. I was derailed. When I was young, I was a teenager, I was raped. I was an old teenager, you know, my later teen years.
No, it wasn't by Bill Cosby, right? Just want to make sure about this.
No, but I, you know, this is so, but it's interesting, I mean, even though you're sort of joking, when I had written a song in the late 70s called 15 Ugly Minutes, and that song was a closure, I thought, for my own experience with having been raped, because I had been warned to stay away from a guy who was a handsome maitre d' somewhere at a club. And I went out with him against that advice, and I ended up, before the word date rape or the reference date rape had come to be, I was on a date with this guy, and I went with him, and I went to his apartment. I was very brutally raped and all that stuff, and there's a whole story.
By the way, this man is dead. He died when he was in his 20s, right?
Yes! My God, you do your...
A little bit.
You are impressive.
Well, I looked it up in the
Talmud. Rabbi.
Yeah. So how he died was a
heart attack.
Good.
He died when he was 26. Now, the thing is, I wrote this song thinking it would be a closure for me. Because back then they didn't have, you know, he died anyway. But the thing is, when I told you I sang in the 70s, that was my beginning, and I sang for about 7 years. I then stopped pursuing my career of being married to somebody else who was a drug addict.
What a life! Oh my God.
But I was, he used to want me, I'm heavy set, or I was more heavy set back then, and my husband used to want me to go to diet doctors so I could get diet pills to give him, because he was the worst drug addict. One night he took an entire huge bottle of antibiotics thinking they were drugs, and he couldn't understand why he wasn't high, but anyway.
And he never got the flu for 7 years after that.
But he got the axe from me. But the thing is that when I started singing again after Vito was dying and died.
Yes.
And the owner of that club wanted me to sing. And I said, why? Everybody's dead. But in Vito's will, he had that I would sing at memorials for him. These certain songs for every young and old song by a folk singer called When I'm Gone. And it talks about doing things while you're here. Anyway, like there's nowhere in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone.
Was that Phil Oakes?
Who did the yes!
Work? Yeah, okay.
I am getting more impressed with you since we just met. The more you say this stuff, that shows you know a lot.
Yeah, I come off as stupid, but there's layers, you know?
That's your persona.
Right.
Dopey. But,
thank you. Baby Jane Dexter just called me dopey. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is,
but in a cute way.
In a cute way. So you sang that for Vito's, not funeral, but
yeah,
his
memorial. Yeah, like at that big college on 8th Street and Lafayette.
Well, that's near NYU.
Yeah, but another Cooper Union.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was like 950. I sang this there, which I sang those songs there after Larry Kramer went on stage saying, AIDS didn't kill Vito Russo. And he's pointing at everybody, the 950 people, saying, everybody in this room killed Vito Russo, because he was referring to people not doing what they should do about supporting, looking for a cure or looking for help for AIDS.
And acting up and all that, yes.
Right. I then also... Vito's lawyer, an agent, really his agent, they sent me to L.A., where Craig Zaden, who's the famous producer...
He's doing that Peter Pan, isn't he, with Neil Marin now?
Yes, exactly.
I know my stuff. Yes, continue.
More impressive.
Thank you.
I keep saying the same thing. It sounds like I'm just like, you know... on my knees.
Well, it's better than calling me dopey over and over. Impressive, I like. Okay, good.
All right, but the thing is that, so Neil and Craig had this big thing for all these people in L.A., and I sang there, and then I sang at the Castro Theater in San Francisco the same song. So it was like a little tour of, and it's like Vito only wanted was for me to sing for people, so it's that was his way. I mean, he put it in his will, so he forced me to do what he wanted me to do, if you will. And so when I came back to New York, I called the guy that owned that little club and told him I was ready to sing. And I started singing there at 88 and ended up, a lot of people came to see me. They did articles about me. A lot of people who knew me from years ago who were still alive
right.
wrote that I was back and they wrote about me and people came to see me Chip Jaffa, for example, Bob Harrington, people from there was somebody from the New York Times, Gary Giddens from the Village Voice, so it caused a little bit of a stir in a what seems like a small category of showbiz, which I have since learned is huge.
Uh-huh.
Because of what you can do for the people who are there in the audience, but what you can give them. I mean, I have chills thinking about what the audience teaches me by letting me know I'm doing the right thing because it affects them. So back to Vito, that's when I started over. Oh, I started over again in New York 10 years after I had stopped pursuing my career, even though I did an occasional show somewhere in the country to try to start over again, but I didn't. So I started over again like in 91 after Vito died at the end of 90. So all these people came, and the thing is, it was at the same time that Willie Smith, attempted rape charges, that Mike Tyson went to jail, that there were these guys with baseball bats in New Jersey who hurt sexually a mildly retarded girl. There was kids in high school in California, Lakewood, I think, or was the name of the high school or the town, who got points for what they did to girls. Does this ring a bell in a sense?
A lot of these things.
They were all happening at the same time. 15 Ugly Minutes, the song I thought I would write that would be the closure to my experience of being raped, never was. And what happened was when I... Now all these things about rape and sexual violence was happening, I went back and and started singing that song again. And it was amazing. I mean, people wrote about it everywhere. I fought for it to be on my first album. And it's the kind of cornerstone of my workshop that I do with the troubled teens or homeless women. You know, I sing that song and I sing another couple of songs I wrote. One is funny and one is... But they're all related to sexual violence. And then I sing other things that are like from my, you know... Wait, like.
I have to ask, what is a funny sexual violence song?
Well, all right, I'm going to sing it to you right now.
Okay, yes.
Okay. It's called Chicky, Chicky, Chicky. I would sing 15 Ugly Minutes. Then I sing this song, which I followed with It's Just a Man's World, but it would be nothing without a woman or girl. So I would sing 15 Ugly Minutes, and then I would sing, the girls and me were hanging around, checking out the guys. When I spot this red hot number, the woman in me cries. We'll get that muchacho. Check it out, ooh, check it out. So I give the sky the eyeball, and my heart begins to shout. Chicky, chicky, chicky. Chicky, chicky, chicky. You got a body like you're a bodyguard. Mira, 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 ain't the body hard. You sure are built like a brick shipyard. How about a quickie? Chicky, chicky, chicky. He turns real red and he calls me a name. I don't know what it means. He tries getting out his temper. I try getting in his jeans. Like I tell him he's 11 on a scale of 1 to 10. It doesn't get him hotter, so I got to shout again. Then comes the chicky, chicky, and the last verse is, I pinched his rear and started to howl. Off my number runs. And the last thing I remember were those perfect little buttons. Well, the girls and me discovered we could still learn something new. Guys don't like it when you treat them like they're used to treating you.
I get it. So it's the reverse psychology thing. That's how you can do a humorous song about sexual violence. Interesting. Interesting.
It was my way of being able to... Let me ask you something. Can you... And then I think... This is a man's world, and it'd be nothing without a woman or a girl, you know, is that about that. So it's like a sequence that made sense, but in a less frightening way than it was when I first sang. Remember I told you about how things are sequenced and unfold?
Yes.
Are important. So what I do 15 Ugly Minutes now, then do Chicky Chicky, and then sing This is a Man's World, the James Brown song, but it'd be nothing without a woman or a girl. I'm going towards making a point that's a little story of that segment of my song. So like years ago when I wrote that song, I sang it with a rock band and I was scary and I was so angry. And it's not that I'm happy about it now, but I can tell it as a story and give it a viewpoint as a woman from saying my problem, how I see the world, you know.
Right, and it's also a woman who has lived a lot longer, who has survived, who has worked through it. I'm sure you got therapy and you got all sorts of things to get you through that horrible experience, you know?
Yes. Well, it's so weird because I couldn't... I didn't in the there's poetic license in the lyric of 15 Ugly Minutes that talks about going in the courtroom and the guy and the judge lets the madman go. And actually, and so that's, you know, you have to sort of make the song work. And she ends up going to a pawn shop, getting a gun and killing the guy.
Oh, which did not happen in real life. His own heart killed him.
Exactly. Little rabbi.
I didn't know I was little. I actually am. But,
That's adorable.
In more ways than one. But,
Oh, you don't do that. That is so awful. I try to do that.
That's what my dear wife Miriam Libby says. Yeah, don't do that. It's
true.
Terrible.
I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, you have to feel good about who you are, and you get what you get, and you use it the best way you can.
Oh, I do. Oh, please. You know, you sang that song, Chicky, Chicky, Chicky. Let me tell you, even now, I can't walk past a construction site without the guys catcalling. They want to pull my pigtails. They want to touch my hat. It's humiliating. I just got that je ne sais quoi, they say. That's
well,
not the word they use.
Now.
We're talking with Baby Jane Dexter. I wanted to ask you, first of all, I did not know that you had, I guess, a fairly recent stroke. How are you?
I am, I'll tell you something, Rabbi Saul Solomon. I feel very good. You notice at first I'm apprehensive, you know what I mean? And then when I get to feel I know the person or I'm comfortable with them, I feel very close to them. That's how I, can you tell?
Well, yeah, because this interview started like the first 20 minutes. I'm like, oh my God, what am I getting myself into? And now I'm like, yes, you know?
And then, and I'm there going, what have I gotten myself into? But the thing is, because I wasn't sure about what was going on, it doesn't matter, because it came to be a good thing. What was that question, anyway?
I don't even know what the hell the question was now. It was,
That you do, yes, oh, yes, and little things, and your wife.
Oh, well, yeah, that's just,
Libby.
And then we moved on from that, I asked you something else. Well, let me ask you something else, even else. I didn't know, you...
Wait, Sahel.
Yes.
Rabbi Saul. I just, the thing is that I don't want to, you know, you, everything in your life, every mistake, oh, it has something to do, oh, yeah, you asked me how, yes.
Oh, how are you feeling? You're the stroke and everything else. Yes, how are you?
I'm pretty good, except I fell down last week and I crashed on my face in a store and a metal went in my eye and they took me to Bellevue and saved my eye and all that.
Oh, my God.
But I had a big stroke years ago and became paralyzed and all that stuff. But that, that's many years ago, you know, like 40 years ago. I mean, then I...
Wait a minute, wait, you had a stroke in your how old were you?
18, yes. And, the thing is that, late teens. But the thing is that they didn't even have CAT scans, let alone MRIs back then. And it was so unusual that they thought it was psychosomatic.
Oh, God. Really?
Ridiculous. Yes. But if you saw an MRI of my head, you would die. Because it's like there's all this missing. A third of my brain is atrophied and washed out in the blood. But I've had a lot of small strokes over these years. And you know how I can't think of the word sometimes? Which is common in people?
Aphasia, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I have. I have aphasia. See, there you are, showing another smart thing. People used to say, like, Bob Harrington once wrote about me when I started singing again in the beginning of the 90s. He said, Baby Jane brings disorganized thought and stream of consciousness to an art form. But because I would just be all over the place jumping around and then asking the audience, what is this thing? Because I can't think of it.
And it was literally because you couldn't think, oh, wow, it wasn't
yes,
an affectation.
But
wow.
I never knew, I just, what it was going to say was that when you have things, like afflictions or whatever they are, something wrong with you, like I always make a joke, like when I was a kid, they didn't have ADD or ADHD. They had get in the hall so you can learn to pay attention.
Right, true.
But but I have all those things, and I just didn't know it. Well, nobody knew it.
Back then, no, certainly not.
Like, there's so many. In fact, you mentioned that folk singer that wrote When I'm Gone.
Phil Oakes, yes.
Phil Oakes. I was thinking about him, how they didn't have things like Prozac and all that stuff. But I wonder if he had had medication that was the proper kind of thing, that he wouldn't have killed himself.
You could, well, then again, you could say that about Robin Williams, and he could have his pick. Sometimes, you know, nothing helps.
No, but Robin Williams, that is so deep and so serious and so important and crushing, and I guess the only way to see the goodness is to understand, like, when he was on the cover of Time magazine, I took it, or maybe it was a Ovid picture that framed the picture, because I loved him so much. He meant so much to me as an actor and was so talented, just like most people. But knowing that he was suffering in a way, it helps to teach people. I don't think that it would have been that he had to find another way. He was so deeply damaged in his, like, he was already on medications and all these other things. But, you know, he was...
They also said that he was diagnosed with something that would have been progressively worse and worse and worse. Maybe that factored in as well. But do you still deal with depression?
Say that again?
Do you, personally, still deal with depression?
Yes. But I do, but the thing that's different now is that I know my purpose. I know who I am and what I do. And that, what happens is, I don't let that get in the way if I can't get a gig or can't. I just have to make it work. So the depression was always related to my singing or some problem with not getting a gig or not, I mean, and it, you know, Robin Williams' last TV show wasn't that well received. And, you know, I believe that he, you know, he was, like what I'm describing myself, he was that person that could do that thing, that could have that effect on the world. That it's, and that was starting to fail a little bit.
And I guess that's the worst possible thing you could tell a performer, is that, you know, the next 20, 30 years, your powers are going to diminish and diminish and diminish. I don't think there's anything else worse you can tell of a comedian or singer or an actor.
Yeah, especially a performer of his stature in the unlimited way he functioned. You know, whenever he went on a talk show, when he was like nuts, like nobody, but he was amazing.
Right.
Not that amazing. Nobody could do, only Jonathan Winters, who was his biggest influence, had that thing.
Speaking of which, I wanted to ask this question as well. In singing Baby Jane Dexter, who were your biggest influences? I think Blossom Dearie you mentioned at one point in another interview, but who did you want to be
Blossom
like?
Blossom Dearie wasn't an influence.
Oh, okay.
She was a friend.
Oh.
But I'll tell you, it's odd. Some of my influences. Well, Anita O'Day, who I don't sing like, but she made me aware of hearing the music in a different way, like hearing what the accompaniment should be, hearing... She was very influential to me. I was singing at Reno Sweeney in my first, you know, beginning, and that was my real first gig. A guy, I was doing self-deprecating jokes, and the guy, this fan of and friend of mine, he actually was the artist on my first album, he painted the cover, he got very upset about what I was doing on stage. He said, "You are a singer. That's what you are. You have to hear singers." And he took me to see Carmen McRae. He took me to see Joe Williams. He took me to see some people at the cookery.
Alberta Hunter. I just thought of the name, Alberta Hunter.
Yes! Yes!
Mazel tov. Yeah. Oh, I knew it was out there somewhere. Okay.
He took me to see Sarah Vaughan, who I later was his best friend, and I became friends with her. I got, he took me to see, and I got to know slightly Peggy Lee.
Wow.
But he took me to see all these singers. He said, this is what you do. You do this, what I'm taking you to see. Forget all that other stuff. And so he was very, my friend Robert Richards was very, very influential in introducing me to influences. And so I guess the great singers.
Well, yes.
McRae was I think she was very underrated. I think she was up there with the Ella, Sarah group of people. But
and by the way, you're speaking, of course, of Ella Zimmerman and that's kidding. I just
riot.
Thank you so much. And it is so delightful talking with Baby Jane Dexter. Let's remind everybody one more time that if they want to see a master of the form sing, you can, in front of you, live in a cabaret situation. She's going to be at the Metropolitan Room. She's already been a couple of times. She's playing the weekend just after Thanksgiving, like the 24th. Is it the
28th and 29th of
November.
November.
And then again,
that's Saturday, December 20, and then Friday and Saturday, December 26 and 27.
All at the Metropolitan Room. This is a lovely place. I've been to there. I've seen, what's her name? The woman who was on Carson all those times. She's there a lot.
I'm there. I wasn't unconscious. I was taken out by the police.
No, I said she was on Carson. The woman who's...
Well, Marilyn
May, yeah.
Marilyn May.
What do you mean you were unconscious? When were you unconscious at the Metropolitan Room?
10 years ago, I passed out on stage, and those guys with the ambulance and everything, they came to take me off the stage and take me to the hospital.
I
refused to go until I sang, "For All We Know, We May Never Meet Again." And the audience was crying and all that. But I had something wrong with me. I now every month get iron infusions.
Oh.
I was very anemic, and I had all these. I'd be in another, like in Hartford, I was about to start a show, and I passed out. And
oh my God.
I've got like a, what are those things, double pacemaker. I got a lot of stuff in there, but it's all good. And now I'm good, except for that I fell down in the shoe store and hurt my eye. But, probably I'll be owning that shoe store.
Were you ever in a terrorist attack? It seems like every possible bad thing, with all due respect.
I was at gunpoint, and when some robbers came into Reno Sweeney at the end of the night years ago, and it was me, Holly Woodlund, if you know who that is.
Right, from the Warhol era, was she kind of?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Holly and another four people, including the owners of Reno Sweeney, the gunpoint people, guys with guns came in. But that's not a terrorist. That's just guys with guns.
Close enough. But you didn't get shot, which for you, I think, is... that's a step up.
I didn't get shot. I was shocked.
Shocked, but you weren't shot.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have had a lot of experience. People tell me you need to write a book or something.
Yes. Yes. Sit down, start.
I saw Solomon. I'm going to announce this because I was just called on your show. Lenny Watts, who is the president of MAC, the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, called me to say I was receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award of MAC. It's like a big deal.
Mit Mazel, Mit Glick. You just found this out?
What?
You just found this out? I said Mit Mazel Tov, I meant. Mazel, Mit Glick, if you...
Oh, yes.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so it's going to be, there are going to be two presented. One to Steve Ross, if you know who he
is.
Oh,
I love Steve Ross, yes.
And one to me. One woman. And isn't that, wow?
That is fantastic. What better news?
It's exciting, but I didn't think, I was sort of embarrassed, and then, you know, like I'm not, I hope I'm not dying at the moment. Although I do have a rollator, you know, one of those things with four wheels. Like when I did a thing at Carnegie Hall, recently did in June, a tribute to Margaret Whiting. I just rolled out on my walker and sat down on the stage and sang from my walker.
You do what you have to do. That's what you do. And it becomes part of the song, too. The visual, the how you're feeling at that moment, you know.
Yes.
It's all part of it.
The thing is that, but you're right. And in terms of that stuff, things that hamper you, you just don't let them hamper you. I think that's what you're saying, right? You just do it.
Yeah, but and also it becomes part of the scene. Because it's not just, as you know, it's not just a song. It's the whole atmosphere at that moment for those 3 to 5 minutes. And maybe there's a line in the song that didn't mean the same thing when you were standing up. And now that you have to sit in this thing, that line has a little extra resonance.
Always variable. Always variable.
Exactly.
You want to know something funny about Steve Ross and me?
By all means.
Years and years again. He was my first piano player, rehearsal pianist.
Oh, my gosh. Steve Ross, for people who don't know, he does shows about Cole Porter, and he's a very dapper, elegant kind of a performer.
Absolutely. Fred Astaire, the whole thing. I mean, that's his thing, doing those incredible shows about a particular person. But isn't that funny?
He does it superbly, and your piano player when you first started out. Well, can I ask you, last question, because we do have to go, but last question for the wonderful baby Jane Dexter is, what is the most recently composed song that you do, either in your act or on a CD? Like how recent is the most recent number?
You mean that I've written?
Oh, or you could have written, or it could be...
No, the most recent, the newest song, I'd say that I'm singing is, Stay With Me. You know, that song's a huge hit around the world.
Stay With Me.
Yes.
I'll hum a few bars.
Sorry. Guess it's true. I'm not good at a one-night stand. This is love. I need a man. I'm trying to think. Won't you stay with me? It's by Matt, who just won some big award on the American Music Awards. It's the number one hit around the world.
Oh, okay. My musical taste, as you know, dips back into the 1960s. But after 1997, I'm pretty foggy. I don't remember.
Oh, you know what?
What?
I did a song, this will go back to you, like this is an example of what people maybe not expect, because I heard it in a different way, and the subject in what my, it's by the Monkees.
Oh.
I'm a Believer.
Well, it's a Neil Diamond song, actually, yeah.
Yes, Neil Diamond, but I mean, I sang it in a way that was, I was thinking about love and about, you know, everything's about love. I thought love was only true in fairy tales. Meant for someone else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw, I'm about to make it higher. Then I saw your face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave you. if I tried. And I went into in this world of ordinary people, extraordinary people. I'm glad there was you. So what I mean is, like, I heard this in the way that I heard it and put it together that way.
I mean, it's lovely. It's just, and again, you take a song that was a bouncy, catchy hit for the Monkees and then from Neil Diamond back in a certain era, and you give it the special feel that you want to, and people can take what they want from it in all different ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I, ladies and gentlemen, I am a believer in Baby Jane Dexter, and
But you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a little believing in Rabbi Saul Solomon.
I'll have you converted from Unitarian yet. You'll be Jewish soon, I'm telling you. But she's... Find out more about her
Jewish.
At babyjanedexter.com. You can also buy her CDs there. And, of course, catch her at the Metropolitan Room at a few different dates from now until towards the end of December. Baby Jane Dexter, I just want to thank you so, so much. It's been really wild and fun and delightful talking with you. An honor.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled. I didn't know this was going to be such a deep interview and all this other stuff.
Well, I have depth. That's I don't have much, but I've got depth. and a joy. Thank you. Yes. Shalom to you.
Thank you, sweetheart.